So hey everyone, welcome to the Know Your Gear podcast. Today we have a pretty exciting guest, one of my favorite guys in the industry. I know that sounds hammy to say it like that, but I'll even tell you guys why. And it's Jack Higginbotham, who is the COO of Paul Reed Smith Guitars. That's correct, right?
That is correct. As far as I know, that's what I've been told.
I've met Jack many times, and this is why I'm going to start this with this, why I really wanted to have a discussion with him. Jack has been a person that every time I met him, he gives you your 5 minutes. He gives you that attention. Whatever it was when we met, I could tell that you always made a point to listen, to interact, and that may not sound maybe special to some, but to some, you guys realize it's a little bit, I like to relate it to, it's a Star Trek nerd meeting William Shatner at Comic-Con, right? You want to hope that he's going to hear out what you have to say, even though he hears it all day, all the time, coming from all of us kind of nerdy guys out here. And I always want to thank you for that, Jack.
That is really nice. That's very nice to hear from you. And some of the best, I remember one time in particular doing a tour with you at one of our experience events, and was just amazed. Maybe this is why you think that I am that way, but you were asking the most awesome questions. And I just, like everybody else on that tour, kind of just blanked out to me. And it was you and me having this walk through the factory that I remember super fondly. It was awesome.
You have been at PRS now for over 30 years, since the beginning, right?
Yep. 1985.
And the reason that's important is this. When you think COO, when you hear a title like that, in our industry especially, right? Because when you think of guitar builders, you think of some guys in a shop, right? Just making guitars. And I think there's a detachment when you hear terms like COO, like maybe you were at Calcan and now you've come over to PRS. But the truth is, you started with Paul at the beginning building guitars, and you've worked out almost every department.
I've done a few things, yes, indeed. And the COO thing is kind of funny to me. Titles are kind of funny to me in general, but the fact that I have one is kind of funny. But I think if I can kind of answer your question in a way, I don't think I'm a typical officer of a company. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I'm here because I love music, I love building instruments, I love Paul's passion, and it's been 35 years now, almost 36, of a pretty amazing journey. And I often wonder how somebody can effectively guide a company at the top when they haven't experienced what fully is going on underneath. And I'm super fortunate, and I'm very thankful that I've been able to travel those paths and do all those different jobs.
And that's a great point. You know, we all know, especially in this industry, one of the most famous, obviously, owners of a guitar company that didn't play guitar is Leo Fender. He didn't play guitar.
Yeah.
So we know it's not absolutely important, but it is a nice benefit. In your case, you're a musician. You've been playing guitar since you were a little kid. So you understand musicians, which is, like you said, gives you a different perspective, I think, than someone who just understands business side of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I've been around music since literally some of the first things I can remember are music. So I know it's had an impact on me my entire life. But I think with this business, it's also about understanding the physics of guitar building and having, you know, you can be taught something and understand the theory and know this is why it happens, but to have actually done it, experienced it, messed it up, fixed it, and discovered things along the way in a really practical sense, I think just makes it all real. And it makes it, we were just in an R&D meeting a minute ago, and some of the things that I learned 30 years ago come front of mind when you're in these meetings. And it's like, oh, you do this and you do that, and it leads you to a better product in the end. We can incorporate some of that thinking into it. And so, yeah, it's like a back room that you can walk into at will and sort of look around. And they're great reminders on how to keep making great guitars and running a good business.
You've been with PRS since the beginning. You it's in your blood, so to speak. You worked there for over 30 years, as we all know. That's a rarity of anybody, any company. And when you achieve that, I think it's important to be acknowledged so that people understand, you know what I mean? PRS is like part of you.
It's weird. It's weird when you talk to people, job shopping and jumping and all of that is, you know. But this as you know, Phil, this is like a house of passions, and it's really very addictive, really, when you get into it, and it's a very difficult thing to let go. And so it's a lifestyle, I think, you know. And I think probably other guitar companies are that way too. It's like, you know, we're a pretty passionate community. I want to kind of just go a little deeper on what you said. I started here at minimum wage in the mid 80s, which was like $4.50 an hour, doing the gruntest of grunt work. And just everything from working on the shop floor, picking out lumber, managing the wood shop, moving around with the different departments. I ran production for a long time, doing purchasing and sales, all that stuff. I just count my blessings that if I look back and say, you know, how did my resume happen? It was because really Paul gave me opportunities to try a bunch of different things so I'd understand the business more globally. And it does, I think, it helps me every day for sure.
So that's the perfect segue to the next question. You just kind of brought it up. The SE line. We have a couple topics or easy ones to talk about. The first one is, and this is something I mentioned to you, and we've talked about this briefly once before when we met, and you had a great answer, so I won't tell everybody your answer, but one of the things I admired about what you guys did with the SE line was disclosure of the factory. And so, you know, publicly on the shows, I've always actually praised you guys and then also condemned you for it, because I don't know if condemn is the right word, but we'll get there. I think it's great that you guys put, you know, hey, built by World Manufacturing for Paul Reed Smith, right? I also think that's also what put that manufacturer on the radar. There's a joke I have, or I don't know if it's a joke, but maybe it's going to sound like one. I don't remember, you know, I've been playing guitar now for 20, 30 years, whatever. I love guitars. I talk about it every day of my life. This is what I do, right? I don't remember when we all started talking about manufacturer origins. Like, I don't remember a world when we didn't do it, but I know we didn't. And now I know we do. I don't remember what happened, but I think it was propagated by you guys being so upfront about disclosing origin of manufacturing.
I think you're right. So the reasoning behind that is, by the time we went to that place, which was around 2000 or 1999, somewhere in there, we wanted to be very honest, is probably the fastest way of putting it. We wanted to be very transparent. We didn't want anyone to think we were doing something weird. That's why the original Santana SE is pretty far removed from what it is that we're doing now, because we wanted to make sure that nobody could say, oh, PRS is trying to pull one over on us. The logo on the headstock was a huge one. It did not say PRS on it at all. We didn't use our trademarks with the bird inlays, and the body shape did have the perimeter, but very few other telling signs that that was a PRS guitar. Then we also said, just to make double sure, we're going to go to the back of the headstock and we're going to write on there, manufactured by World Manufacturing in Incheon, Korea, under license to PRS Guitars or something like that. And that ensured that nobody was confused. And it also ensured that the manufacturer had skin in the game, that they were part of the team that was bringing that product. You know, when I built a guitar back in the day and I glued the thing together and made the guitar and set the neck angle, I put my signature in the neck pocket. And that was a really good thing for quality assurance and a bunch of other practical reasons. But it was a good thing for PRS because I was emotionally attached to having done, it's like signing a painting. I was done with it. I put my signature in it and I was responsible for it, and I took better care of it because of that. Those are some of the reasons that led to all of that transparency. And I believe we were the first people to do that inside of the industry, where we ask the manufacturer to put their name on there, and we still do that now.
I think you guys were the first to do it. Regardless of that, you were the first to popularize it. So if somebody was doing it, it wasn't popularized yet. It wasn't a thing. And to be honest with you, here's what's really funny. As powerful as it's been to the consumer, right? Think about this. The consumer's really bonded with that idea. It's funny to me to this day how many companies didn't take that lead. You know what I mean? There are some. Don't get me wrong. There are some companies out there, like Reverend puts that it's done by Mir. You know what I mean? There are companies that are doing it. But most companies still actually not only don't disclose it, actually some companies, as we know, go out of their way to kind of hide where it's coming from. You know what I mean? Oh, so obviously another topic, since you guys, like I said, you guys open this can of worms. So it's your worms you have to deal with, right? Which is, you're like, hey, this is who makes our guitars. And then of course, now when you change factories, unlike many companies that change factories and no one notices, and as you know, some companies can change factories in the same year multiple times, much less over terms of years, you guys have changed direction. So you're now 100% with Cortec, right? With the SE line, is my understanding.
When Guitars in Asia started, it was Jack Westheimer that went and started all of this thing. And it was in Japan, and he went there in the late 50s. And he didn't even go for instruments. He went for sporting goods. But just through this series of events, it turned into me losing an earpiece. It turned into musical instruments. And it was in Japan that he saw this opportunity of a country that needed this industry and a world that could benefit from that country's talents. So he went in and he helped to develop what was the guitar industry in Japan. Japan goes through the 60s, they recover financially, inflation is happening, the cost of living is happening, the standard of living is rising. Doesn't make sense in Japan anymore on a large scale. And so he starts looking around and he saw Korea and he went to Korea. And when he went to Korea, he met a gentleman named Young Park, who is a gentleman that I know, who is the founder of Cortec, who is Cort as we know it. And Jack Westheimer, along with him, formed the Cortez guitars, if you recall those. And that's what started guitar making in Korea. So what happened in Japan, it inflates, they move, they go to Korea. Now you go through a couple of decades inside of Korea and the same thing is happening. Standards of living are increasing, costs are increasing, wages are increasing. It's becoming what it is that the world is looking for, is this cost-effective guitar, which isn't so much of a no-brainer in Korea anymore. And that, recognizing that, is what caused us to start looking and seeing where the next place is, where can we go that has a partnership, somebody that understands us, somebody that understands the guitar, somebody that enthusiastically can embrace our idiosyncrasies, that we want to do things a little bit differently. And that's how we found Cort. And it's been a wonderful experience. And there's videos that I know there's a video that we have on our YouTube channel that's a factory tour of the Indonesian factory. Where we have our one facility, is three buildings actually, where the SE Electrics are made all under the three roofs, you know, there. But being able to take that approach with a partner like Cort has been pretty phenomenal and engrossing project for me. It's really absorbed it's absorbed me for the last couple of years. It's been a weird flashback to 1985 at times, on just sort of starting over and scaling things and working on quality assurance. It's just all of that thing we talked about at the beginning, where those weird jobs that I did for the past 35 years kind of rolled into that moment, and I think helped us to navigate the reinvention of this line.
I know your first guitar was a Sears guitar. So do you find like that memory, you know, that the frustration of trying to play on a guitar like that, do you find that fuels any kind of fire with you making these kind of SEs and stuff?
Absolutely. Like it's the thing. So yeah, when I was a little kid, it was my mom was an employee at Sears in Greensboro, North Carolina, where I grew up, and there was the employee store, and that's where that guitar came from. So it probably was a reject of a $10 guitar to start with. And all I remember literally was bleeding and thinking, I love music. I love the sound of these notes that's coming out, but this is a horribly painful, painful experience. But I suffered through that, and I'm glad I did. But one of the things I often think about with the SEs is it warms my heart that what we're trying to do, and I hope we're doing it, is we're trying to make an inspirational instrument at a price to where it's not necessarily somebody's first guitar, and we've never really wanted to be the cheapest game in town. I don't want to have the $10 guitar that I had when I was a kid. But we do want to have a guitar that is, if you make the stretch to that first tier of price point, you know, for us would be an SE Standard, that's a guitar you can pick up and be inspired by, that it's not going to make you bleed, and that if you are a gigging musician, you pick it up and you say, all right, I like this guitar. I can use this guitar. I like this guitar because the frets are level, the fretboard edge has been rounded, the nut's comfy, the switches feel good, and you know why you like that guitar. But if you've never picked a guitar up, all I can hope for is the person is going to say, it is a pleasant experience and I'm inspired to sit down with this thing and keep at it. And if they've got that music inside of them, inside of their head, that we're kind of that conduit that lets that music out. That's the hope that we have for this series.
I think I've asked a couple people at PRS and I don't think I ever got the answer, but I'm going to ask you, and you can not answer to, what does SE stand for? Or is that going to be forever the debated thing on the internet?
It's going to be forever debated, the thing on the internet. And it stood for many things in those early meetings. Honestly, it was talked about in the meetings. And if you put a gun to my head and say, which one was it? It was all of the things that you hear out there. At the end of the day, it is it, you know, it just became an entity. And I guess 4 years ago, something I felt really strongly about is I no longer wanted us to distance ourselves the way that we had distanced ourselves with that project. And so I was really lobbying to put the Paul Reed Smith logo on the headstock and the SEB, the suffix. And I think it took a long time to get there, but that is home. That's proper. And regardless of what it stands for, what words those letters stand for, what I think it now means is this is a way to become a part of the PRS family. It's a way to get a quality guitar at a more affordable price point. And it's a series that I think that now people know that we're dedicated to exploring with the same mindset that we do the guitars in Maryland.
Now, 35 years of PRS existence in the industry, you now make, obviously, so many price categories. It's very impressive, right? I mean, you have affordable, and I dare say that because you can upset people now, affordable priced American-made instruments, but you do. You have more. We know S2. In fact, there's a great interview with you talking about this, so we don't have to talk about this, talking about the birth of those guitars coming from the last recession. You know, you have, of course, the core models, which are expensive, private stock, which, of course, is some of the most expensive instruments in the industry. Now you have not only SE, which is, again, trying to be a more price point of efficient. There's layers of SE, right? You have standard versus, you know, and acoustics, and now, of course, amplifiers. And so the question I have with that, now that PRS has a broad range of products across so many vast categories, there was a time, as we all know, everybody's heard it. Paul's heard it 1,000 times. You probably heard it 1,000 times. You know, they're doctor lawyer guitars.
Of course, everybody says this. I knew you were going to say that.
My joke, oh, by the way, was they always forget engineers. So every time they say they're doctor lawyer, I'm like, engineers make six figures, yeah. And they buy guitars probably more than anybody. But anyways, My point is, there's nothing, in my opinion, there's nothing inherently wrong with that statement. I understand what they're trying to imply is that real musicians don't buy these guitars, but if you look at the artist roster on your website, it's some of the most comprehensive real musicians I know. I'm a huge Steve Vai fan, but Dave Wiener's who made me notice PRS guitars. I saw him play with Steve Vai, and his tone was killing it. You know what I mean? And my comment, I don't get sidetracked, my comment about Dave Wiener is, that's a guy who, if he doesn't sound great, he doesn't get his gig anymore. Although we could argue that comment and whether it's valid or not, it seems weird now to associate or say it anymore to a company who's actually opened up all the price categories to where now, I even said it on my question when I wrote down, I said, now you guys have guitars for beginners, professionals, and collectors. So my question to you is, what do you feel you've learned from the fact that you now have this diverse product line? You do have doctor, lawyers, professionals, artists, beginners, you know what I mean? Are you seeing a change in the company mentality, thoughts? Does it change you as a person of the company?
It doesn't change anything in the way we approach guitars. It just opens up more opportunities to make new types of guitars at different price points, if that makes sense. And I think it also takes down the boundaries and fences of where the business can go going forward. If you asked me 10 years ago where I thought we'd be today, we're in a different spot in many ways than where I would have said 10 years ago, we'll be here, you know? But what those moves that we make inside of S2, SC, you know, when we're playing around with acoustics, when we're working on electronics packages that, you know, Lloyd Baggs and us designed these things 20 years ago now, to reinvent those things in a package that can go into an SE. It's like every time you do that, you just expand the options for the future of where you can take the guitar, where you can take the platform as it goes forward.
I think sometimes when there's a discussion about Paul Reed Smith guitars, of course, like any company that does a variety of products like you do, the exotic stuff gets the attention. It becomes the focus, and as it should, because it's the most exciting things to kind of talk about. But sometimes I think there's perspective loss of the fact that you now are a more diverse brand of products. Like I said, there isn't a entry point other than, like I said, we know the very basic, like $100 beginner students. I understand you're not in that platform, but every other platform on up, you've opened up to and made product for. So like I said, it's a pretty diverse brand now.
Yeah, we just want it to be a real instrument. It's like, at what point can it be a real instrument? An instrument that, you know, a person that doesn't play guitar can pick up and enjoy it, and a professional can pick it up and enjoy it. That's the boundary right there. I think that's kind of where it is that we want to go. We're not interested in making a guitar-shaped object. You know, it's got to be a guitar. That's a famous, Doug Shive is one of the guys that I work with inside of the SE thing. And I have to give him a footnote on that one. That's a Doug Shive original, guitar-shaped objects. We don't make those.
I got to tell you, one of the things you said today that I absolutely love, I'll be using it from now on, and it pertains to that same conversation we just had with the $100 guitar, which is when you said that your guys' goal is to remove obstacles.
Yeah.
And I use I love that, because one of the things that you hear sometimes, you know, you started on a Sears guitar. I started on a very horrible guitar. The guitar I got was because the only music store open on a Sunday when my parents could take me was this one that had just this horrible guitar. And and I love it when musicians as a whole, like a badge of honor, says, oh, I had my first guitar was horrible, and that's how I learned, and everybody should learn on that. And I love your saying about obstacles, because I agree, you could put every obstacle in front of somebody and they could still become a guitar player. But that doesn't mean you should. You know
what I mean? That's right. That's right. Why make it so hard? I'm with you.
So I love that. I'll be quoting you for a while on that. I love removing awesome. Obstacles. I think that's great.
No charge.
That brings us to the next one, which of course is not a fun subject, so I don't want to spend too much on it, but I think a lot of people will be interested to know how PRS is handling COVID right now. You know what I mean? What have you done? What are your plans? How is that working for you guys?
First of all, we've worked very tightly with we're in Maryland, in the state of Maryland, and we have incredibly good relationships with the state. And our Secretary of Commerce is Kelly Scholz. And Kelly and I were talking at the beginning of this. And, you know, if you recall, and I'm sure you do, there was just so many unknowns around all of this and how are we going to navigate? And we have 375 employees and we want everybody to be safe. And so in talking to Kelly, one of the first things that happened with us is she asked me to be on our governor's manufacturing task force. So we had a very proactive role in saying, working with other manufacturers to establish best practices and how to reasonably implement those best practices, not just at PRS Guitars, but in an advisory role to other manufacturing businesses. So that was a lot of what I was doing every day during the quote-unquote COVID shutdown. We were working around the clock.
I know one of the things that was interesting about you guys particularly was you were able to retain like 100% basically of your employee base, right? They were able to come back. And that's, you know, and that, let's be fair, that was a real concern for a lot of people. You know what I mean?
That was a big, and it was, it's a weird thing. When you're at the beginning of something like COVID and you don't know when it's going to end or if it's going to end, those are scary times that you have to make some decisions. Because in retrospect, it all looks pretty easy. But when you're in the moment saying, here's how much money we have, here's how long we can afford to pay people, how are we going to play this? But we made a decision that there were several very important things for us. Number one, our employees are everything. The people that build the guitars, it's not, you've been here and you know this, it's not just like take this part, put this here, do this, you know, it's art. And the artisan spirit is alive and well here. So one of the things we wanted to do was not disrupt people's whole worlds, you know, in a world gone a little bit squirrely, we wanted to try to bring it down a level and keep it calm. And we felt like by keeping, not doing the furloughs, keeping people on payroll, and we all took a reduction in pay to make that happen, it would be less disruptive. And again, the employees, man, while we were in here kind of pulling our hair out a lot of days, the amount of positive feedback we got from the employees was phenomenally energizing and inspirational. So, but the PPP definitely was a helpful thing for us as well. So the all the different elements of what the government and what the community did to support us, you know, helped see us through the times. And so when we were able to come back, we had a workforce that was still employed. Again, in retrospect, I think we did the right stuff to, you know, just to do the right things and also set the company up to when we came back in that we were able to go back at 100% with gusto. People were phenomenally energized when they were able to come back and do what they like to do.
One of the other things that was, you know, disheartening this year was it's your 35th anniversary. It's a milestone. It was going to be a big deal. And of course, that had to be shelved for the most part. You guys able to do the virtual event. I mean, you guys have still injected as much excitement as possible. But, you know, it's still, it was the situation that it was. But the reason why I bring up the 35th anniversary is, there was a big change this year about something you guys did with the products, and I'm curious to see what was the reasoning, because I think it's been really well accepted, which is this year you guys made the decision to change the finish on the instruments, right? That's my understanding. And so all instruments, even S2s, so it's S2s and cores, everything is going to like more of a nitrocellulose lacquer finish. And in my personal experience so far with the community of guitar players, is very well excited about this because it's, I don't know why, maybe it's the mystique of that finish, maybe it's whatever it is, but I was curious to see if you had any insight of was that something because you were conscious about the 35th anniversary that's changed things up again? Was it something evolving? What was the logic behind that?
In our world of guitars, there's always the holy grail. There's always something that's out there. There's always a way to further the instrument. And Paul is, that's his world. You know, his world is just tenaciously looking at all of the details that go into the making of a guitar and pressing the boundaries of what's even reasonable to do to be able to bring that to full-scale manufacturing. So the ability to do a change with finish, it's years in the making. And it's only, you're only able to do it when you've proven to yourself that you can do it effectively, you can do it safely, and you have made a better product at the end of the day. So there's really no connection to that, although it looks like there's a connection to that. Like our 35th anniversary guitars are intentional. That's a very intentional thing. But some of the peripheral things that happened through this year, you could pick any year and probably say, you know, make an argument that those things were as impactful.
You know, one of the things that I've always felt is I always like the V12 finishes, all the finishes you guys have done. I own many PRSs throughout the years, and they have different finishes, and I can't actually say I like one more than the other. There's no particular versions of the PRS. I know that's a very geeky road to go down, but there's variations of the PRS.
I'm with you.
You know, we know between the tuning keys, there's different versions of birds. There's different versions of guitars throughout the years of PRS as it's evolved or changed over the years, right? And I've never particularly found like any argument in my personal opinion that says, oh, I only need this neck joint option, or I only like this finish. But actually, right. I like it that you guys change things up every few years through either changing some of the aesthetics or some of the physical features or just changing out pickup options. It's always because, for me, I actually, of course, we all love vintage guitars. Everybody has some kind of connection to it. It's music, right? They made music. We love music. There's our connection. But the idea that nothing will change 10 years from now bums me out. You know what I mean? The idea that everything will be the same.
And I am so with you. And that obviously isn't really the way we roll. So that's not likely to happen around here. And I think I was talking to Judy earlier today about this. And we talk about this. It just pops up in conversations. One of the cool things about this place is that we do change a lot, and we've always changed a lot. And from the first day that this place was open to the fifth day it was open, it changed. You know, it's been changing. And I think we are, it's more acceptable to the community when we change because we always have. We're pretty, well, I'm not young anymore, but we're a young company. And The one thing that is consistent in this is that it isn't consistent. We have never really been typecast, not to any real degree. So we have the flexibility to go places and have the permission of the market, I think, to let us go places than maybe other people might. And I think, you know, I think it all kind of boils down to our quest to just... It's what you said. We grew up, music was such an integral part of our lives. It's so deeply woven inside of us that the point is to get to that music in your head, however you get there. And the fewer boundaries that you have, the more options you can open up to realizing that fact, that you can go to places. The Silver Sky being a good example. It's really, you know, there was a moment where it's like, wow, are we really going to be able to get permission from the public to do the Silver Sky? And it was pretty controversial when that thing came up. But because Paul and John had such due diligence through that project and had explored their own questions so thoroughly, when people started picking them up and playing them, they understood. And it was quickly, it went from a question in the market to acceptance in the market. So that's a good example of, I think, how we can change things and will change things. It's not likely to end.
The Silver Sky is, to me, since I've been doing this YouTube platform, this podcast platform, the Silver Sky is, to me, the absolute best analogy of the internet. I used to hate, when the Silver Sky came out, I used to hate talking about it, because every time it came up, there was this, I dare say outrage, but at some level, some kind of pushback, to the point where I, like you, was like, man, maybe this wasn't the best decision for these guys. And then now, you know, because I have one behind me, now it's one of your most successful products. Everybody loves it. And to me, it now becomes, in my world, unlike, your world is a guitar building, but in my world, it becomes this reminder that maybe the internet doesn't know what it wants yet. You know what I mean? Maybe it doesn't have it all figured out, because the results of the reaction don't line up.
What Paul often describes, and it's now really deep inside of me, is we're tool makers. We're making tools. And if you really think through everything that tool is supposed to achieve and approach it from that point of view, that's, once it gets to the public, if we've done our job in prototyping and vetting that instrument, once it gets there, if we've done our job, I think we do have a well-thought-through tool. And even if it's an unusual tool for us, even if it's something out from left field, it's like, ooh, PRS has never done that before. The public has the faith that we, hopefully most of the public that knows us anyway, has the faith that we've gone through due diligence to, first of all, come up with a tool that works well, but it may not even be a tool that you know that you want yet. But once you experience it, you suddenly see the use and the value in that. Like our piezo systems, that we've done for years, and now in the SE hollow bodies, that's sort of like born of a notion of, wouldn't it be nice if you could convincingly do this, this, and this, and how would you pull that off in a recording situation, in a live situation? And that guitar is the result of wondering that.
I appreciate your time, especially now. I know it's even more precious than normal, because we're all just, dealing with so many things, and you got a lot of hats on and stuff.
Well, I appreciate that, but this has been a fantastic hour. I love talking to you. So I really, really appreciate you having me on.
I thank you for that. Everyone else, I just want to say thank you. Make sure you check out, I'll put all the links and everything to the PRS stuff. I'll put also everything that Jack mentions in the video. I'll make sure there's a link to the corresponding either tour of that factory, like your Indonesian factory. You have that great video on your website. I'll make sure there's links and everything, so if people are interested, they can check that stuff out. And as always, I want to thank everybody for their time. Till the next time, know your gear.